Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we pick a new book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm happy to say we have, as our Gat on the show, we've had him on the show before about another book, but he's written yet a new book called Nations, The Long History and Deep Roots of Political Ethnicity and Nationalism. This one is every bit as pathbreaking as his last one, which I believe was called War and Human Civilization. Is that right, Azar?
Correct.
Yes, okay. And yes, this one is every bit as piquant and feisty and interesting, and I hope it turns a lot of heads and changes a lot of minds. It did mine, so I really encourage you to go out and read it. It takes directly on what I might call the received view about nations, that is that they are quite new. They are invented or imagined, I suppose, is the catchphrase these days. Azar doesn't think so, and after reading his book, I don't really either. Actually, truth be told, I never really did. But his book provided a lot of evidence for what we'll talk about as the traditionalist line on the origin of, ethnic communities and their relationships to politics. So, Azar, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for hosting me.
Sure, my pleasure. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm Israeli, and I'm a professor and the chair of the political science department at Tel Aviv University. Most of my life I spent as a researcher of war, and then I've turned my attention to other subjects as well.
So tell us why you wrote Nations, The Long History and Deep Roots of Political Ethnicity and Nationalism.
Well, I was troubled by the turn of opinion, starting with scholars. It started in the 1930s, but then a return in earnest from the 1980s. With the idea that nations were somehow new, that the connection between a state and a people was something new and modern, that it only started, say, from the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, or perhaps a little earlier with the Print Revolution, earlier in the early modern period, and this view became very fashionable. It resonates beyond the scholarly circles, and I believe that now every student in the humanities and socialism sciences is groomed on this idea. So I never believed this was true, so I had to write a book about it.
Yeah, I know that I have a daughter she's 4 years old. She's just barely 4 years old, and she's already gotten the idea that she's an American. She says, "We're in America now. It's not like other places."
That's because she's a modern child.
Yeah, I didn't teach her that. She's like, "That's the American flag." I'm like, "Yes, it is." So I quite agree with you. Let's talk a little bit about the origins of this particular idea that nations or the national state, let's put it that way, and it's modern, is an invention. Who founded this idea? Where did we get this notion?
I think that this notion has two origins. One is that modernity indeed has created a huge, generated a huge transformation. Nobody's denying this. People moved from rural communities to cities. They became became subject to military service in most countries during the 19th century. They were received universal education, which imprinted in them the ideas of a national history and so forth. So modernity was obviously a huge change, and nobody is denying this. The question is whether or not they felt a sense of being a people and identified themselves with a particular state before modernity. And that's the question. And the other origin was the revulsion and against the manifestation of chauvinist nationalism during the 19th century, during the 20th century, the horror and the atrocities caused by nationalism, particularly during the Second World War, Nazism, and so forth. So there was a tendency to belittle the national factor to try to argue that it was, as I said, that it was first of all immoral and illegitimate, but also a modern invention, contrived, and we should just get over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things you point out in the book I quite liked. It might be controversial, but I don't see how. Many of the people who were the theorists of the modernist position, that is, that nations are modern, were in fact kind of deracinated types themselves. They had fled, usually Central Europe, and exactly. Ended up someplace in the English-speaking world. And for them, nations were sort of invented because they got a new one.
Correct. Most of the modernists were refugees from Nazi Germany during the 1930s. Actually, all of the leading modernists, except one, all of them fled persecution and national chauvinism during the 1930s. Came to the United States or Britain, and it was they faced a very painful question of identity. They rebelled against the dominance of, against their life experience. So it was quite natural for them to regard nationalism as insignificant.
Yeah, and then many of them are very brilliant people and sympathetic folks. And I think it's very good to put it in that kind of they were the subjects of nationalist oppression. They definitely were. And so one could see why exactly. They might wonder. I also wonder, though, that, Marxism is an interesting thing, and you mentioned it. Marx didn't really pay a lot of attention to nations except to say that they'll go away. And many of the people that were the founders of the modernist position were, if not Marxists, on the left.
That's right. That's right. Though Marxist doctrine does not really recognize the nationalist factor, communists are quite aware that there were nations, and that so both the Soviet Union and other countries in the Soviet bloc at the time, particularly Yugoslavia, regarded themselves as multinational states, and at least in principle or in theory, believed that peoples had the right of self-determination, that they would, the Soviet Union, as I said, at least in theory, was organized along these lines.
Sure, that's right. So there's another strain as well, and I guess I might mildly disagree with you about the origins of this, in the sense that I this notion of civic nationality or civic identity that you can actually find in the French Revolution. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of people that think about nations don't like them, and haven't liked them for a long time. And that has something to do with this notion of sort of a universal identity, or the kind of universalism that you found in French revolutionary rhetoric. What do you think about that?
Well, that's absolutely true. But the fact remains that most of those who profess to be not to like nationalism live in particular national states, identified with these nations. We have this famous expression by Jürgen Habermas, the German philosopher, about the constitutional patriotism, but obviously people identify with the constitution of their particular state and particular people. It's and the French Revolution itself, even though obviously mm-hmm. it proclaimed universal principle and so on, it was centered on the French people. It centered on the French people. And French civic nationalism centers on the French people, the French language. It makes it easy for people to join the French nation if they accept the French language, French culture, and so forth. But it very clearly centers on the French state and the French people.
Yeah, I think that you could probably one acid test of this is to see which team you support in the World Cup. And I'd be willing to bet.
This has been called banal nationalism, and it very well exists in the liberal West today. People forget that nationalism seems to be in decline only because it has been accepted so widely.
It's true.
If people feel at home, so they it's like good health. You miss it only when it's gone. So when people are securing their home countries, and they feel that their country expresses their national identity. So the whole question of nationalism receded to the sidelines. But even in the most liberal and comfortable countries, like, say, Canada, or these days the United Kingdom or Spain or Belgium, when the national, when the question of what your identity is returns to the front line, as with Quebec or with Scotland or with the Basque Country or with Catalonia and so forth, so it immediately becomes obvious that the national question is a very salient one.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true, and there are a lot of funny examples of that. I mean, I think that. Well, just to give an anecdote, I always ask my students, this is here in the United States, of course, whether they can imagine a form of political community other than the democratic nation state. And they can't. There just isn't anything else that could conceivably be legitimate. So you're absolutely right. I mean, they don't, you know, 40 years ago, people might have said, well, you know, socialism, or I don't know, you know, there was a sort of thoroughgoing, I don't know, there were nationalisms of various kinds. But it just doesn't really exist anymore.
Right. National identity has become transparent to people where in those places where national identity has national sovereignty has indeed been achieved and is regarded as fait accompli.
Yeah, well, it's part of the world. I mean, I think that's the way they see it. They don't notice it anymore. It's just exactly. part of the world. And so let's talk a little bit about the substance of the book itself. One of the things I really liked about this book, and I liked about your previous book, I hope I didn't skip any, War and Human Civilization, is that you begin at the beginning, and that is with the evolution of particular human traits, mental traits, psychological traits that are dealt with by evolutionary psychologists and things like this. You don't shy away from that, and I think that's good. I know that in my own work I've done the same thing. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, what I might call the evolutionary origins of preferment or attachment or preference for people that, I don't know how else to say it, except look like you or act like you or something
right.
like that. Yeah.
Right. For throughout most of the 20th century, the whole notion of human nature was regarded as completely out of place. The social sciences believed and the humanities believed that man was wholly shaped by culture, by history, and so forth. But the idea of human nature has returned in the past decades, and it's now based on the logic of evolutionary theory. And we know that people from the very beginning, and the very beginning of our species goes back perhaps 200,000 years. They lived in small groups, and they showed a close attachment to their kin and to those who shared culture with them. And people, and this is, you know, this is often referred to as tribalism, and the tribalism has always been a very strong sentiment. People show attachment to their close kin and to their culture alike because they are their kin and because their existence dependent on the well-being of the group. So these traits have become, in a way, engraved in our evolutionary heritage, which we carry throughout history. Obviously, it has gone through many transformation and changes. People do no longer live in tribes in most of the world, but larger communities have developed peoples and nations and states emerged a few millennia ago. But still, the trait that we saw that we show preference towards our those whom we regard rightly or not as our kin and those who share the same culture with us is still with us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, nobody questions the notion that you are predisposed to, let's say, like your children or maybe your siblings, although people hate their siblings sometimes, sure. than other people. Everybody accepts this. And there's good And there's a good evolutionary logic behind this. You mentioned in the book kin selection. That is the notion that by helping somebody with a lot of your genes, you're actually helping yourself. It's not really altruistic. I think that the challenge becomes to see how that notion, that is kin selection, preference for people with a lot of your genes is transferred to preference for people with fewer of your genes. Because another thing you point out in the book is that, let me see, how do I put this? A French person is more likely to share genes with another French person than they are with, say, a Chinese person.
On average.
Yes, on average. Yes, that's right. Yeah, on average. Yeah, that's right. So, but that challenge, getting over that leap, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is one can see how the mechanism is, in a certain sense, hijacked, because humans are very good at noticing similarities and differences among themselves, for example, in facial features.
That's right.
We're extraordinarily good at it. And, you know, many species can't even recognize their own kin. So we are definitely wired to do this and give them a certain amount of preferential treatment. And again, another thing you point out in the book is that this is the way we lived for basically all of our existence before the state appeared.
99% of our existence.
Yeah,
95%.
That's exactly right. So let's call this group the tribe, and obviously there's a certain amount of altruism within it. That is, people will sacrifice their own interests for the interests of these other people. When does the nation appear, or the ethnos or ethne, some people call it?
I argue that nations appear as early as states, and the first states appeared 5,000 years ago. And the nation came close on the heels of the first states. We have several kinds of states, city states and empires, which are multi-ethnic. But in between them, we have the so-called territorial state. And what I am suggesting is that these territorial states were actually national states, and the first national state was the first large state, ancient Egypt. And we have many other examples which are still with us, ancient China, Japan from the time of its consolidation as a unified state about 1,500 years ago, and then many others.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you spend a lot of time in the book on definitional issues, which I suspect was probably not very pleasant for you, because the terminology itself is sort of messy. So what in your conception is a nation?
A nation is a definition by one of the modernists. The nation is a rough congruence between a people and a state. If you have a particular people with a certain culture and a certain ethno-cultural traits, and it's more or less congruent with a state, and I'm suggesting that this congruence is not accidental, because it's that much easier to create a state within a space inhabited by a single ethnos, because of the sense of homogeneity and then solidarity. So if we have this rough congruence between the state and the people, or an ethnos, this would be a national state and a nation.
So these nations appear with states. That's roughly 5,000 years ago. I guess my question would be this: as a historian, how do we know, in terms of positive evidence, that people, that is both common people, conceived of themselves to be members of something like a nation? And how do we know that the people that ruled them also conceived of themselves as rulers of a national entity?
That's a very good question. And there's obviously a big problem involved, and that is that most of the population could not read and write. They were illiterate, and so that we have no record of what they thought and what they believed. That was, 90-95% of the population in most historical societies. So, but this is what the modernists, based on this, the modernists claim that they did not actually have this wider sense of belonging to a broader nation or a people. But we have the actual behavior during crisis, and people would habitually during crisis, say during foreign invasion, would rise to defend the nation, the state, their country, their culture. And we see this throughout history, and I think that would be the best evidence of what they felt, and the authorities which usually disenfranchise the masses would, in time of national crisis, would call upon the people to rise in arms, to come to the to fight the foreign invader and so forth. So they too had a good reason to believe that such an appeal would have would be successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think our audience, the obvious example, the great font of evidence for this among the masses of people that listen to this is, in fact, the Hebrew Bible, which is full of that sort of stuff.
Quite right.
Yeah.
But the Hebrew Bible has long been regarded, even by modernists, the Hebrews themselves, has long been regarded as an exception. They were regarded as unified by the special religion, by the practice of Torah reading, which meant that the literacy was more widespread among them, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the same was true with other peoples and with other nations throughout history. They always rose against the foreign invader. The authorities could always count on the people to be loyal to the state in such emergencies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I know that in the Russian case, which is the one that I've studied most deeply, very early on in what we think of as Russian history, really Rus history, we do see, in fact, this. Immediately, you know, the Mongols come and nobody doubts who they are and that they're different and that the people of the Russian lands should fight them. Exactly. And the people of the Russian lands were Orthodox Christians that spoke some dialect of Russian. This is evident in pretty much all of the texts. Although it is the case that it becomes stronger and weaker. Interestingly, in the Russian case, it becomes weaker for a moment. My own empirical investigations would suggest that's true. I mean, and there are other things as well. I think you talked.
Bloody foreigners were always bloody foreigners.
Yeah,
that was a very strong sense throughout history.
Yeah. Well, it's commonly said that Americans never know they're Americans until they go overseas.
Absolutely. I mean, you need to have contact with the foreigners to see that you are different, that you are your own identity. That's uh-huh. also a common trait of national communities.
Uh-huh. How does religion work into this? I mean, in the Hebrew case, that one's quite clear. Can you give some other examples of the ways in which?
Well, yeah, people, modernists, especially Anderson and others, have suggested that the identity of people was mostly religion rather than national, that they belonged to a Christian community or to a Muslim community rather than the nation being their primary identity. But this was not the case. I mean, before universal religions, most religions were actually national. I mean, the religious identity itself was part of the national identity. Even when universal religions arose, like with Christianity and so forth, even then there were always national churches of the universal faith, and the national churches were always patriotic. They always upheld the national cause, and even in those cases where the country was overtaken by foreign invaders, the church was quite often the repository of the national feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I think the case of Christianity is a terrific one for the points you're trying to make, because I was raised a Lutheran, for example, and so Lutheranism is at its origins a national splinter group from Christianity, and I know that it's even been assimilated here in the United States, so that the kind of Lutheranism that we practice here in the middle part of the United States is very different than the kind of Lutheranism which is practiced in Germany, let's say. So this tendency for different ethnic groups to assimilate religions to their own national I guess, habits is a very strong one. I was talking to a woman the other day who studied, she actually studied a Jewish activist, female Jewish activist in the United States. And she mentioned to me that if you want to study Reform Judaism, you go to Cincinnati, Ohio. that's where the kind of this American brand of this Reform Judaism, like Cincinnati, Ohio. There's no more American place than Cincinnati, Ohio. Right. So yeah, this assimilating tendency is very strong. And early on, and as you point out in the book, I mean, Christianity is a universal religion. It's supposed to be, you know, this is the ideal. It has not worked out very well. Sorry, but it really has not worked out very well because these churches have all been nationalized.
Right. It worked quite well, but not as perfectly as people imagine.
No.
Or as Anderson imagined.
No, that's exactly right. So if we go ahead and we agree with you that these national groups existed, that they were political groups and sometimes religious groups, that in times of crisis, they always rallied around this sort of central notion of common identity. What is different then about the modern nationalism? Did the modernists have, do they have anything to offer us about what happened in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century with nationalism?
Sure. There has been an erosion of local identities because before modernity, 90% of the population lived in a scattered rural community. Now they were all thrown together in cities and were, as I said, subject to universal education and to military conscription and so forth. So there was a stronger sense of unity. There were improved communication, better education, and so forth. And in addition, there's been this notion of popular sovereignty, which also made what the people wanted the cornerstone of legitimacy and also of political authority in many countries. So for modernists, this was actually the beginning of the nation. As I see it, it was more of the deliberation of the nation. I mean, the people had always been patriotic. Now they also called the shots politically, and then they expressed their preferences very clearly, and their preferences were clearly nationalistic.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. One of the things that is commonly said about modern history is we move away from multinational empires and to nation states, and the idea of popular sovereignty is definitely involved in that. And one of the things that people will also say is that these multinational states didn't really pay a lot of attention to that they were not national states, that they were explicitly sort of tried to poo-poo the notion of nation. Is that true?
Well, it's only partly true. I mean, they were all obviously multi-ethnic, but nearly all, if not all, empires in history were built around an imperial people. There was an imperial people in the middle of each empire. I mean, it was the Russian people in the Russian Empire. It was the Turks in the Ottoman Empire, and so forth throughout history. I mean, there was an imperial people here. Obviously, the empire was in the interest of the empire to present itself as universal and to make all its subjects equal subject of the empire. I mean, they were all equally under the heel of the empire, but were regarded as equal, and they were the empire encouraged them. Especially the elites of the various ethnic communities within the empire to participate, to serve the empire, and to rise in its service. But still, there was the reality of the imperial people at the center of the empire, in which the power of the empire rested, mm-hmm. on which it could count as its main means.
Yeah, I mean, and I think another thing that is interesting is that if you believe what the modernists say about empires, it's difficult to explain why there are, I don't know if constant is the right word, but there are periodic ethnic uprisings. I mean, the case of the Jews is a particularly interesting one in the Roman Empire, but also the Gauls, also the Britons, they just wouldn't settle down.
Of course, over time, as in the Roman Empire, there could be a process of assimilation. I mean, ethnic and national identities are not constant. may change over time, and people may change identity and adopt another one. And in enduring empires, it could be the case that many of the peoples over the century would assimilate into the main ethnicity of the empire. It happened in large parts of the Roman Empire, where the population of Gaul and Spain adopted Latin and began to see themselves as Romans. And then the same obviously happened in China, and then in many other empires. But still, there was, again, even here, there was a close connection between ethnic identity, whatever it may be, and loyalty and to the state.
Yeah. The Byzantines thought of themselves as Romans, but they weren't. the Romanians speak a, you know, they speak a Romance language, but they're not exactly French. And I know that it's the case that, at least in my own studies of the Russian elite in the early modern period, is that, you know, they did make some attempt to assimilate foreign princes, especially Muslim princes, but they never made it to the top. I know this for a fact. This is one of my very few findings in all of my scholarly studies, is that if you're a Muslim, you really couldn't go that far. Well, you had to convert, first of all. You absolutely had to convert. There's no way you could get into the Russian court without converting. But once you converted, then there was a kind of a glass ceiling, because it was a Russian empire.
That's exactly so. So there was always ambivalence in the attitude of the imperial authorities. On the one hand, they would love to see the other ethnicities within the empire, you know, converting into their own. Assimilating into the core nation of the empire, and whenever this was possible, they would pursue this path. But when they sensed that this would be impossible and only incite resistance, so they would opt for an inclusive and non-assimilating policy. And both policies were there.
Yeah, I one of the things I found fascinating in the book is there are some passages in there you quote about the Yanomamo. I think many people probably know who the Yanomamo are. They're a tribal group, and it's in South America, isn't it? I'm sorry.
Right.
Yes.
I'm
and they say that they are the first people, and that they are the best people, and that everyone else is more or less, I don't know how to put it, just not up to snuff. Now, it's funny, because in my own research with the Russians said, the early Russians, that is, before they sort of met the Europeans, said exactly the same things about themselves. Exactly.
It's true of everybody.
Yeah, that's why I think so, too. So this notion that somehow ethnic prejudice, or I guess what we'd call it pridefulness, and also xenophobia, these are not unusual things at all.
Sure.
Yeah.
They're universal.
Yeah, it was striking to read these passages and think, you know, I just read the Russians would say the same thing. Europeans would come to Russia, and they would come to the Russian court, and the Russians would be very disdainful of them. Even though the Europeans were much more advanced in many ways.
Sure.
The Russians were still totally disdainful of them. But, you know, they just weren't, yeah. So, yeah, these things lie obviously very deep in the human breast, I think. So one of the things I think would be interesting to talk about is the way in which nationalism is playing out today. I talked to Francis Fukuyama, I guess it was a year ago, about a book that he wrote about political evolution. And one of the things he said was that areas of the world which are still tribal, I mean, they may have a common ethnicity among the tribes, but these are particularly, they're having a difficult sort of transition to modernity. Can you talk a little bit about that? They really haven't quite formed nations yet. I'm thinking mainly about areas in Africa.
Sure. I mean, first of all, there are many stretches of the world where tribalism is still very strong. So a wider national identity has not been formed. But in the case of Africa and parts of Asia as well, one of the problems was that the boundaries between states in say in Africa is. Were drawn by the European powers during the 19th century with total disregard to ethnic realities. So what you have is different ethnicities thrown together in the same states, and some of them finding themselves in different states, different neighboring states. So when the African states gained their independence in the 1960s, it was clear that, you know, redrawing the map would cause total mayhem because of all the all the usual stuff that happens when you try to adjust ethnic boundaries and political boundaries, and so they vowed to leave everything as it is. But this has worked only partly successfully, as we see in many African countries, and which we have two cases of splits in existing state, the last being the split between South Sudan and Sudan itself on ethnic grounds. And we have ethnic trouble throughout Africa, where tribes and above tribes, where ethne find themselves in disharmony, and sometimes this may degenerate into civil war.
I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that we, in the last 200 or 300 years, we have embarked on a great process of sorting people. There are countervailing trends as well. I mean, there are some people that, you know, I think like Armenians are a good example. They're everywhere. But generally speaking, these ethnic groups have consolidated, particularly after World War II. I mean, you think about the Germans, they were all sort of shoved back into Germany.
Yes.
And I mean, do you see this process continuing?
We have to remember that the process in Eastern Europe, and as you mentioned, the Germans, was a very violent process.
Yeah.
I mean, the German was simply driven out from where they lived in throughout Eastern Europe, and in Eastern Europe in general. I mean, we had the example of the disintegration of Yugoslavia. I mean, when ethnic communities are mixed together, it's very difficult to align political and ethnic borders. So the process itself is maybe hell, but. So whenever ethnic community can get along with each other, it may be very good for them to stay together. But sometimes they simply do not wish to. I don't pretend that I have the answers for such cases. I'm just trying to give an accurate description of what the actual state of affairs is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I quite agree with you, and I think that, and I'll say this if you won't, that the notion that somehow nations are invented or have some sort of slight hold on our consciousness is dangerous when we're making policy about these places, because I think that taking that notion too lightly is been proven to be a mistake, particularly in the Central European case.
Let's take Iraq, which has been in the headlines. I mean. The U.S. presidents used to talk and still talk about the people of Iraq, but there is really no people of Iraq. I mean, they are the Iraqi people. There are people in Iraq which do not see themselves as one people, or at least some of them do not see themselves as belonging to the same people, certainly not to the same nation. This is particularly true with respect to the Kurds in the north, which once the tyranny of Saddam Hussein and his predecessors has broke down, has actually gained de facto independence, even if the jure are still part of the Iraqi state. So and even the Shia and the Sunni do not see themselves as belonging to the same collective. And we see the same process in Syria. I mean, there is a people in there are people in Syria, but there is hardly a Syrian people or a Syrian nation. And once the tyranny of breaks down, you see the various communities of Syria at each other's throat.
Well, I want to ask you about a more. I don't know if it's more important. Probably in your area of the world, it's not more important. But Americans think a lot about China these days. And China is an empire. There are large, large ethnic groups in it
sure.
that are not they do not have any sort of national representation. Do you have any opinion on what's going to happen there?
Well, we must begin by saying that 90% of the Chinese are Han Chinese. So,
yeah.
So they are the majority people, the majority nation. Is overwhelming, but there are about 50 something so-called ethnic group or nationality, minority nationalities in China. The most problematic in this respect, from the point of view of the rulers of Beijing, are the Christians and Muslims, the Uyghurs of in Xinjiang in the northwest. And so long as there is you know, a Chinese authoritarian or totalitarian system in place, they are unlikely to be able to break away from China. And if and when there is a regime change in China, which I'm not sure is going to happen anytime soon, there might be renewed appeals for national independence on the part of both the Tibetan and Uyghurs.
And I also want to ask you about the United States. You'll pardon me for saying that I'm a big believer in American exceptionalism. I don't think there's a Polish friend of mine who lived in the United States, and he was about to go back to Poland. He said to me as his parting words, he said, you know, the United States is not a country. It's an experiment. And I think that's pretty much right. Is there American nation? I mean, how does your theory, how does all this play out on American soil?
Of course, there is American nation. Americans feel that very strongly. I mean, there is an American people, there is an American nation. Obviously, it's a nation and there are people of immigrants, and people are quite aware of the fact that they came from different places, or that the ancestors came from different places, and then some of them still have a warm place in the heart for the old country. And obviously, there are also religious differences that still play out among the various population, but the people also share in a very strong sense, not only of loyalty to the American to the state and to the Constitution, as many people posit, but to a common American culture. People speak English. They put their old languages behind them, and from the second or third generation, people speak English as their first or most cases as the only language. They partake of an American, of a distinctly American culture, even though they may retain symbols of the old ethnic identity. So above all, the culture is American. That makes an American people and an American nation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I quite agree with you. One of the things I tell my students when we talk about nationalism in Europe in the 19th century and people fleeing nationalism in the nations of Europe is that America solved the problem of nationality by reducing ethnicity to food. So you come to the United States and you open a restaurant.
Absolutely.
And then the next generation, your son or daughter is a doctor. And it's over.
Absolutely.
Ethnicity is for Sunday afternoon meals at grandma's house.
Right. In America.
In America. Yeah, just in America.
What is called ethnicity in America is precisely that.
Yeah. No, and it's a curious thing. I mean, and one of the things that holds Americans together is this notion that we are a nation of immigrants. This is on everybody's lips.
Sure.
Nobody ever forgets this, and nobody can ever forget it. Because sure. it's a kind of political sacred cow, which is why we have such trouble with immigration reform and things like this. We're always very ambivalent about it, no matter how much it hurts us. We just can't bring ourselves to do this because the central point of our nation is that you come here, you get one generation, and then you're going to become like us.
Sure.
That's the basic deal. It's a pretty good deal because a lot of people want to come here.
The fact is that people do want to come to America.
Yeah, it's a pretty good deal. Now, not to mention, I mean, there are nations in the United States, of course, there are all the Native Americans and things like this,
sure.
and there are large ethnic subcultures in the United States, but they are explicitly sort of placed under this larger American identity, which is, I think, as you point out, very strong. It's
sure.
You know, Americans go overseas and they immediately recognize that they're Americans.
Sure. Just don't forget it because, I mean, the idea of a nation of immigrants is very strong, and the multi-ethnicity and all that. And all of these are obviously true to a certain extent, but the overwhelming reality is that people from all over the world come to America and become Americans, not only in terms of citizenship, but ultimately also in terms of culture, language, and all the rest.
For good or ill?
Mostly for good.
Yeah, mostly for good. Yeah, for good or ill. But I mean, I think the same thing could probably be said of Canada. I think in Australia, similarly, I think it's a little bit like that in Australia. I don't know. I've not been to Australia.
Yes, New Zealand. In Canada, Canada is a good parallel because we see that where there is a competing ethno-national identity very much entrenched, as with the Quebecois. So there is a problem of how do we of maintaining the nation, and the threat of secession or of splitting the nation along ethno-national lines is there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I also think, yes, that's right. I also think that we should give Israel some credit as well, because a lot of Jews go to Israel. I was going to say go back to Israel, but they've never been there. And they become Israelis. I mean, I've had friends that have done it. I mean, they were as American as they could be, and their kids are Israelis. That's what they are. They're Israelis. This does happen. I'm also interested to hear what you think about the European Union.
The European Union is a union of nation states. You can see this very clearly during the current crisis where national identities again become very much strong. It's the idea of bailing out other members of the European Union by investing your own money is very problematic in the eyes of the richer peoples of Europe. So it's a union of national states, and what is more, we have more and more of them because of the European nation, because the smaller nations of Europe now find that they have the European umbrella as a convenient broader framework, and that they no longer need to belong to the historical nation to which they belong. And we see this in, say, in Scotland and in Catalonia and then in other places. On the one hand, it's obviously a broader framework than the national framework. And over time, who knows, I'm a little skeptical about that. If they develop a stronger sense of Europe as a culture, as a common cultural identity and so forth, they become more like a nation. But at the moment, and in my view, for the foreseeable future, it's going to remain a union of nations.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Unlike the United States, there's no common culture.
Exactly, no common language.
No, there's no sort of center there. I mean, I guess the most influential group in the European Union is Germany, but people are clearly not going to become Germans. And it's not even clear the Germans want them to become Germans. So I guess I would be interested to see, having spent some time among immigrant groups in the European Union, Spaniards, for example, are all over the place in the UK. Right. It'll be interesting to see whether they raise their children as, English or Irish or whatever they happen to be.
Most of them are going to assimilate, as with immigrants anywhere. But most of the majority of the Spaniards still live in Spain or in Castile, more technically. So and they are going to remain Spanish or Spaniard.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you a kind of controversial question, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but it is interesting to me as a matter of public or national policy. Let's take the Germans for example. I don't know if they have these rules anymore or not. But they did at one time have rules that said that you could come and – actually, I know I have a friend that did this. His parents had – he was Jewish, and his parents were kicked out of Germany in the 30s. And he – because he was of German – quote-unquote German descent, he was able to get German citizenship just like that.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So there are these laws that treat the descendants of people, and these exist in Israel as well.
Yes.
Preferentially, I think most liberal people don't like this at all. Is there, but again, thinking about your argument, it seems like some accommodation should be made for these natural feelings of, I guess, ethnic solidarity. What's your feeling about that?
Well, my book is not a normative book. And
yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. And so my own belief is that norms and values are mostly subjective things. And obviously there are different norms here among states, and each reflects a different attitude by the country in question. I see no problem with the idea of those who are regarded as your kin people that are somehow scattered. Therefore, with the Germans, for example, there were large German minorities, as we said, throughout Eastern Europe and in Russia, and the idea that they are your kin and that they are entitled to come back and rejoin the nation. I see no problem in it.
Yeah, I think that's a very realistic way to look at it. And I'm glad you point out the sort of odd similarity, it's hard to say, but between the Germans and the Jews. They were both scattered after World War II. And so for the Germans to say people of German descent come home, that's not, I don't think that's an illegitimate thing. I personally am hoping that the British offer me citizenship because my people came here 200 years ago, driven out of England.
I'm sure they will.
I hope so. That would be very nice. Well, Ezra, it's been really terrific talking with you today about your book, Nations, The Long History and Deep Roots of Political Ethnicity and Nationalism. Let me ask our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
I'm working about a book provisionally entitled The Causes of War and the Causes of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an offshoot from my War and Human Civilization, now concentrating more directly on that question. It's time we knew why people fight and why they don't.
Yeah, no, I would like to know that as well. I try to fight as little as I can. The older I get, the less I want to fight. I just don't have time for it. When I was younger, I loved it, but now I just don't have time for it. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for listening to the New Books Network today. We've been talking with Ezra Gad about his book, again, Nations, The Long History and Deep Roots of Political Ethnicity and Nationalism. Ezra, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for hosting me.